Hello, listener, and welcome to yet one more episode of the Zeitgeist Tapes. I hesitate to put a number on it, but more than you'd think, more than you'd think. Today, me, Emeritus Professor Stephen John Fielding, I thought I'd just put my middle name in there just to make it sound even grander, and my co-presenter, Ms. Emma Burnell.
That's me.
Playwright, etc. I mean, I just
mostly been a playwright.
Mostly been a poet at the moment. Yes, a very successful play. Yes, of which great things are expected and have been said. Today, listener, we're going to go back in time. To 1971. To talk about a Carry On film, Carry On at Your Convenience, which was released in 1971. And the reason why we're doing it, listener, is because at the moment there's lots of talk about unions, about strikes. There's a lot of some old tropes, really, from the 1970s that are being sort of dredged up about union barons, about people being held to ransom. I mean, all kinds of right-wing stuff that many of it originates in ideas about the role of trade unions, the illegitimate role of trade unions that some people on the right and elsewhere do have. And so we thought, I think at the prompting, nobody is going to be taking responsibility for this film.
No.
Emma certainly isn't. Somebody suggested we might want to look at it. So this is why we're doing it. And you might note, listener, that I'm trying to justify why we're talking about this film quite carefully. So just in case our listener is not too aware of what a Carry On film is, because we might have an international listener, who knows. The Carry On films were a series of about 30 very cheaply produced movies that emerged, I think the word emerge is probably the correct verb, from the bowels of the British film industry from the late 50s, mostly into the later 1970s. There was one revival in 1992 that was very ill-judged. And the general theme of these films is they're kind of like, sometimes they're parodies of old sort of movies like Westerns, horror films, The Raj, those kinds of films. And sometimes they are just set in a contemporary setting. They increasingly became kind of coarse, focusing on sex as a sort of jokes. Usually when there's a sentence with it in it, it is sex, and therefore it's meant to provoke all kinds of amusement. So Carry On at Your Convenience is, it's produced in 1971, and it's set in a toiletware factory. Well, W.C. Boggs is the name of the name
and
of the
factory.
And that's
the level of humour we're basically talking about.
Yes. And it's set in a factory, and it has an industrial relations context. The 1970s, certainly in 1971, you know, this is a time when the unions are very strong, relatively strong, and there's quite a lot of strikes, and they become a political issue. They're becoming an increasingly important political issue, culminating in the winter of discontent of 78-9. I think that's about enough context, really, Emma.
Yeah.
That's kind
yeah.
of...
I mean, it basically, yes. If you want to understand a Carry On film, they're essentially a saucy Blackpool postcard brought to the cinematic world. They are...
That's how they would like to be seen, yes.
Yeah, they are lecherous men chasing busty women. The humour is more often not just in the sex, but in the lack of sex. Almost nobody ever actually gets any in a Carry On film.
That is certainly true. And given that kind of theme in it, the films, I mean, for someone like me of my generation and listener, I'm very aged. I'm now 60. But someone like me, I was brought up in the shadow, in the dark shadow of the Carry Ons when they were put on TV.
They were the thing that you watched before the Avengers while you were having your tea.
Something like that. And they were, I remember looking at the TV, the Radio Times, Christmas edition Radio Times.
Just sit there marking everything you were going to watch.
Yeah, that was when Christmas started, when the double issue Radio and TV Times came out. And I remember the joy of when I discovered that Carry On Up the Khyber was going to be put on either the day or two before Christmas or just after Christmas Day. But it was a kind of a treat. And now I realise how infused with all kinds of attitudes, which we will get round to discussing. It's kind of a bit weird, and no wonder my generation of men, I think in particular, turned out a little bit weird. And I also remember on a very wet and not particularly happy holiday on the Isle of Wight in 1972, when it was so wet you couldn't do anything else but go see a film, my parents took me and my sister to see Carry On Loving. Ooh. Which now I've seen Carry On Loving, I'm thinking, why weren't social services alerted to this? How can we were let in to see this film as children? But anyway, so it's kind of infused, you know, British culture, at least for a time, maybe less so today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I imagine that people, say, a decade younger than me, and I'm about a decade younger than you, really have no reference with Carry On films. And anyone yes. who's grown up as part of the YouTube generation really doesn't. I mean, they will know Sid James as a GIF, essentially. And Barbara Windsor as a pub lad, maybe.
Yes, that's certainly true. Yes. Sid James is in this film, but Barbara Windsor isn't.
Barbara Windsor's not, but she was in most of the Carry On films. But yeah, the spirit. People who've come out of it, Sid James was in, I think, all of them, basically. Have Carry On without Sid James, although I think the 92 one did, obviously. Yes. But as someone who has been told frequently that she laughs like Sid James, I have a filthy laugh. So my laugh falls somewhere between Sid James and Scooby-Doo, which is a bizarre laugh, but true.
Yeah. We'll have to hopefully get an example of that maybe on tape.
he was absolutely iconic for both of our generations, and I think probably the one above us. But as I said, now, if he's known for anything, it would just be something like a reaction gif, and people probably wouldn't know who they were posting of the bloke with the funny laugh.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So Emma, after you watched Carry On at your convenience, you sent me a message and said that's 87 minutes that I won't get back.
87 minutes of my life I'll never get back.
Yeah, which suggests you weren't quite keen on it. So what was your take?
Well, I was talking to my neighbour had to come and collect a parcel earlier, and he said, oh, when are you around? And I said, well, I'm in all day, but I'm podcasting in the morning and the afternoon. So if you come between those two, that'd be very helpful. And he said, yeah, what are you podcasting about? And I sort of explained the Zeitgeist tapes. And he said, oh, what are you doing this month? And I said, oh, Carry On at your convenience. And he said, oh, I don't really know Carry On films because he is younger. And I said, well, the thing is, like, some of them are funny. Like, take out the appalling attitudes and the... or even just accept that sometimes that can be dumb, but is also quite funny. But this one, for me, I didn't even raise a smile. I didn't snigger. There was just no humour in it. Like, nothing about it made me laugh. And I was, I was quite up for watching a Carry On film, bit of nostalgia fest, back to my youth. As I say, we used to watch them around the dinner table when I was a little girl. But I just, at no point was I, oh, these attitudes are terrible, because I absolutely expected that going in. It was more just, oh, this film's really not funny.
Hmm.
I mean, so I was like, despite it being a short film, it was not a, it was not short enough for me.
Well, Amazon said it was 86 minutes, but you came out with 87. Longer. I'm not sure. Not sure what it kind of included, but I thought there was some humour. I mean, but not much. No, I mean, to be fair, I've probably seen this film maybe 3 or 4 times because it's sort of on. It's still on. I mean, it will probably be on ITV4 like over the Christmas period because they've probably got, you know, they probably pay about 1p. To the production company to do that. So they always show loads of Carry On films on ITV4, so it probably pop up. So I've seen it quite a bit. And normally, had I not have to watch this for doing this, I probably would have given up at some point. Because I do remember that the last bit isn't particularly like you said, it's a relatively short film, but they're still padding it out. And they made sometimes 2 films a year. I mean, they were really churning it out, and they were churning them out. So really, we're not really going to say talk about it as a kind of an example of humour, but maybe as an exemplar of certain attitudes.
Well, this is
through the guise of humour, people accessed.
This was the first Carry On film that didn't do very well. It didn't make back its money at the box office, which they'd all done before. And it didn't make back its money until about 1976 through TV sales.
Wikipedia does tell us this, yes.
Yes, I did look it up just before we got on. You probably wrote the Wikipedia entry.
No, God, no.
But I think although it does tell us about public attitudes, one thing it might tell us is that there was a battle of ideas going on around unionism in the early 70s. And I think this possibly tried to take the wrong tack, the tack that didn't actually chime with its audience.
I've read elsewhere and on Wikipedia more recently that there is this suggestion that the reason why it didn't make its money at the box office, as cheaply as it was made, was because of its attitude towards the trade unions, which we can discuss. But I don't know where that's said. I don't know what justification there is, because the first thing I would say is that the attitudes that were expressed in Carry On at Your Convenience, I have seen, because I've looked at for work purposes. Purely, simply, obviously, listener. Lots of situation, ITV, BBC situation comedies of the time. And they're pervasive. You know, these weren't necessary. If these were unpopular attitudes, they were being expressed in, like, for example, Love Thy Neighbour.
Yeah, no, racist. Again, comedy. I want to separate out the sexism, racism, general carry-onisms. Attitudes from the specific thing about the trade union thing, but also I think that a sitcom on a national television channel is different from a series of films that are very specifically marketed at the working class. So the attitudes, the social issues attitudes would have been prevalent across classes. So that wouldn't have been, exclusionary then. Certainly not to the majority white working class. But the majority white working class were members of unions in those days. They're not anymore, but they certainly were then. And, you know, all of a sudden, the Carry On people are poking fun at them.
Yeah, although I mean, when I was talking about attitudes, I did mean including attitudes that are very hostile to trade unions. Like for example, like I say, Love Thy Neighbour, which is infamous now for being racist. You know, had a white couple and a black couple, and the white male guy is trading blows. You know, he's the one that comes out with all the anti-black epithets. In that situation comedy, he is a Labour-supporting trade unionist. It's made very clear what he is. And he's also made clear that he's lazy. I mean, the lazy trade unionist who is not interested in Brotherhood of Man, but is interested in their pocket, their wages and nothing else, and don't really care about anything else. That's a standard, I mean, which is kind of exemplified in Carry On at Your Convenience, is a standard trope. In 1970s situation
trope,
comedies.
But I think it's a standard trope that found a broader audience on a sitcom where people from across the classes might have been watching than for films that had always been marketed very specifically at the people who go on holiday in Scarborough or Blackpool.
Or the Isle of Wight.
Isle of Wight, indeed.
Yes. Although most of these sitcoms that I'm talking about were specifically, I mean, there were middle-class sitcoms and working-class sitcoms. And these are working class sitcoms. But nonetheless, yeah, I'm just saying, maybe it was a reason why they didn't do so well. But the attitudes that were expressed in this film are also pervasive, were pervasive at the time in comedies. So because many of the people that wrote situation comedies were themselves quite right wing. You know, yeah. They might have come from the working class, but they're very right-wing attitudes. So, but anyway, shall we talk about the attitudes expressed in the film? I mean, we can talk about the sexism, which is part of the wider politics, maybe to be expected. But we just talk about the industrial relations sort of view, the view of industrial relations via Talbot Rothwell, the screenwriter for Carry On at Your Convenience.
Yeah, I mean, basically, the union guy, he wants to go on strike all the time. Kenneth Cope. Yeah. He's just constantly, like, trying to wangle it so they can get off for the afternoon, get off down the pub, get off to the footy.
Yes.
And there's no kind of understanding of strategic approach to striking or the fact that they might have a genuine grievance. So there's one of the subplots, one of many, many subplots, is that they might start making B-days.
Oh, B-days, yeah.
This is the only time where I actually saw a joke that did speak to some of the complications of union life in the 1970s, because the grievance that was raised over this was, well, some people are pipe fitters and some people are something else fitters, and B-days need both and they can't do both, and it was all so that was the only time, because most of the time he was like, let's go on strike because there's football this afternoon.
The
B-day issue, there was actually genuinely like, well, your jobs and roles and responsibilities are going to change, so what do you do about that?
Yeah, it was about restrictive practices, wasn't it, which was one of the classic sources of dispute when employers wanted to change working practices. And of course he's got his union rule book that's always in his hand, and he's always referring to subsection 3 paragraph 2, looking for reasons for why they should go on strike. But the Kenneth Cope sort of shop steward figure is kind of seen as isolated, isn't he? I mean, he's kind of forcing.
Yeah, is the thing. He's the shop steward, presumably elected by his shop floor, and yet they all get completely wound up and knocked off by him.
Yes, I mean, in this particular incident, the one about the B-days, which, I mean, the whole episode about the B-days is just says so much about Britain and then, and possibly even now. I mean, the idea of B-days has been utterly hilarious, and one character can't tell the other character what it's actually for. They have to whisper to the. And anyway, so there's that. But Vic, who is the shop steward, because there's this bit, we don't do clips anymore, but there's this interchange during the course of this restrictive practice thing where he's saying to the workers, you can't do that because you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And they actually go, well, you know, we don't really care. You know, we want to do this. So we don't want to go on strike. It's our union. And he says, yes, it is. So you'll do what you're told.
Yeah. Which is, you know, I mean, it's so, I mean, there were problems with the unions in the 70s. There were internal democracy problems. There were problems that they were sometimes institutionalizing some of the attitudes that Carry On are famous for themselves.
Yes.
But It just didn't feel like the joke was hitting the right target for me. And maybe that's because I'm a mad old lefty union member. But it just...
I would think GBU's...
The really interesting moment for me, actually, in terms of industrial relations, was Sid James's last line, where he gets called management and he's like, no, I'm not management. And there was a really interesting, actually, just for a moment, glimpse into that problem of social mobility and class consciousness.
Yes, because the Sid James character is the foreman, the works foreman. So he's not, I mean, so he's this kind of, he negotiates between the management and the workforce. And he's kind of pragmatic. He's sensible. Yeah. He's kind of like, how do we get through this? And the son of the owner is kind of like more strident, his time in motion. And he kind of helps provoke one of their first strike. They're the first strike. There's at least two strikes in this. And the Sid James character is, we can get through this by a bit of compromise. And although he's living in a semi-detached house, I mean, he's doing betting. That's how he gets some extra money. But he doesn't want his daughter.
Very clever budgie.
Very clever budgie.
Another subplot I didn't really understand.
I think that's quite fun. I think that's quite a bit of a
funny
thing.
It's funny. It just bizarre and random and out of nowhere.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Way of putting Hattie Jakes in it, wasn't it?
I think that must have been the only way. Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so his daughter, who works in the canteen, Sid James's daughter, he doesn't want his daughter to go out with the son of the boss, because he has this kind of, as you say right at the end, he's got this sense of class, which he thinks is somehow it's not right that this should be happening, even though he's actually is part of management. But he's got that sense of, I mean, that is kind of interesting. I mean, I think that probably was, they were trying to make the Sid James character more sympathetic, but it does say something about class. But also, just to go back to how the unions are presented, at the end, towards the end, Kenneth Cope has got these bother boys on the picket line, and they've all got baseball bats and cricket bats to stop the workers going back to work. Which is then undercut because all these women, because of course women in this, and this may then sort of phase into how women are presented, but the women in this film are, although actually a lot of the workforce, aren't they? They're not interested. The women are seen as being, you know, we want them to get back to work, blah, blah, blah. So it's women, it's when the women all kind of charge up, and the men who are going to just do what they were told when threatened with a baseball bat. It's the women that break the strike in a rather Freudian way, because Vic, who is a sexual inadequate, I think. I mean, mostly are sexual inadequates in Carry On films. You're absolutely right when you said that at the start. His mother hates him. You know, he's lazy. He's a complete tosser as far as she's concerned. And she ends the strike by getting him over her knee and spanking him, sort of unmanning him, sort of completely... And at the end of the film, he has been almost symbolically castrated. He's completely, he's tame now, isn't he, Vic, the shop steward?
Well, not only is he tame, but they finish the joke with turning his union book into toilet paper.
Into toilet paper, yes, which has been referred to in the earlier on as well. So there you are. It's kind of, it's like insofar as there's a sensible kind of political economy that emerges out of this film, it's that, well, workers are workers, but, you know, they can get on with management. Management aren't that bad, really.
No, the management aren't like evil monsters in it at all.
They're not even monsters. Kenneth Williams, who's the boss, goes off on the works outing. So they're all kind of, it got a commonality. This is like organic one nation tourism to some extent.
I mean, in many ways, so was the 70s. I mean, this is before the Butscolite consensus was broken by Thatcher. So actually, we were, although we had a more consciousness of class than we have now, we also had much more class mingling into, you know, an easier route through from working class to a reasonable middle class lifestyle. I think that there is something to be said for the small factory industry that this represents, that is missing from our understanding of the workplace now.
Mm. Well, yeah, they had a works outing. That's another. I mean, how many firms have works outing? I mean, it was terrible. They went to Brighton. I wouldn't want to do that. But that was kind of part of that culture of that time. There were still works outings. There was still a tea lady that would go around on the factory floor. Here's some tea. I mean, it's kind of like a cozy little world, really. That is no longer with us. I mean, the idea you have a tea lady.
Can you imagine the time and motion study on the tea lady?
Well, that is why in the film the tea lady is going to be phased out because of time and motion.
Yeah, exactly.
Then she's brought back
because
in.
Because the sun very much represents that new approach to corporatism, doesn't it?
Yes.
And of which neither his dad, who was traditional factory manager guy, nor the workers are very keen.
No. Although, and here's the thing, which I hadn't really realised, but I should have done. Just in the same way that Vic, the shop steward, is tamed or emasculated or neutered by the end and is changed. So the son of Kenneth Williams, played by Richard O'Callaghan, he marries Sid James's daughter. And at the end, everybody's happy. So everybody's reconciled. He's no longer this kind of time and motion guy.
They've all come together in a big lower middle class fudge.
upper working class, lower middle class, yeah. Sort of fudge, yeah. And the company is saved, and they're making 1,000 B-days for some sultan.
The French. For a sultan, that's right. It's not for the French, it's for a sultan.
No, for a sultan.
So that they could have a funny Arabic name, basically.
Absolutely. So that we're getting some reference to toilet stuff. I mean, it's literally toilet humour. I mean, it's toilet humour.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been a big fan of scatological humour. I mean, sometimes I've seen it done very well. I went to see Trainspotting Live, for example, recently, ooh, which is extraordinary. Okay. And the scatological humour in that is so well done. And you can imagine the scenes that I'm referring to.
I can now. Yes. Yeah.
But usually it's not my cup of tea, but I can tell the difference between when it's done well and when it's just phoned in. And this just all felt more phoned in than a standard carry-on does, even though they were always done at a ridiculous rate.
Well, I think the problem for the carry-ons, and this might also be a reason why it didn't do so well and was the first one not to do so well, is that they were becoming increasingly coarsened. And there was a market for this. This is why they had confessions of window cleaners. And there were lots of variations, which took it to another level.
Alice, I mean, Robin Astor follows me on Twitter, so I'll hear nothing against the window cleaner story.
All I'm saying is that they were coarser versions of the carry-ons. But unfortunately, for the carry-ons at this point, the central figures, like Sid James, were getting older. And it just looked a bit inappropriate for them to be, doing that.
Girls didn't get older. The women got older. So they were very loyal to their cast, which is good. They didn't get rid of the Hattie Jakeses and the Joan Sims and all of those people.
Yes.
But the girls that Sid would chase got younger and younger and younger, and Sid got older and older and older, and it just got grosser and grosser.
Yeah. Although in this one, he has a kind of frustrated romance with his next door neighbour Joan Sims, who works in the factory too, and they clearly are in marriages which are unsatisfactory for both of them, and yet they don't do anything.
They
don't it's kind of sweet, mate,
but they have a wonderful what would it be called now in nowadays part emotional affair.
Yes,
they have a wonderful flirtation, basically, and I really like the fact that neither of those people are what you would call conventionally good looking. But they are both portrayed as well sexy. Well, yes. I mean, okay, maybe Jones when she was younger, but by this point, she's not who you'd
call. Matronly. She was matronly. Yes.
And she was still seen as really sexy. And I love that, actually. Yeah. That's one of the real plus points for this film for me.
Yes. I mean, she did get her bum slapped quite a bit by
That's
Sid.
That's less of a good point.
Yes. Yes. Do we want to talk about the sexual politics of this particular film and how it
I mean,
should wound everybody up.
I would, as I said going in, I just expected it, so I wanted to see it done well.
Yeah,
like to be funny, to be, and there are carry-ons and carry-on moments that are very, very good and very, very funny.
Yes,
and I just, this wasn't it. And so it was just a lot of sexism. And that, like, I can take funny sexism, but
yeah,
sexism without the funny is just sexism.
Yes. I mean, even towards the end, I'd forgotten about this bit, but when they're coming back from Brighton after their work's outing, and then they go to a series of pubs on the way back. And it's done in a kind of Benny. This is like almost Benny Hill before Benny Hill, where so everything's speeded up and the music's speeded up, and they're going in. And I mean, they're all going to getting drink, and then they're all going to having a wee behind a tree. But it's kind of like the formulaic stuff. It isn't. You're absolutely right. It's not one of the better Carry On films. Those are in the later 60s. They were. There's a sort of period at least. Carry on up the Khyber, and Carry On Screaming, Carry On Cowboy, and these are all parodies of certain film genres, which often were very clever. And this is it's like the writer wasn't really sure what he was doing, so he got the story from the series of Daily Express editorials. Really.
I mean, in a way, it felt a little bit like a parody of one of the Ealing comedies or something. So when we did Passport to Pimlico, I could see a route from there.
Yeah.
But not a good one.
I mean, the way in which everybody is kind of reconciled at the end, you know, then that's kind of the classic way of ending any kind of comedy, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, that's literally isn't the actual definition of comedy that it all ends in a wedding?
Well, it's the world turned upside down, but then it's everything's righted again. Yeah. So, but it did bring to mind one. There's a Gracie Fields film from the 1930s where she's an employee of a factory that's being shut down because of the recession. And this also involves the son of the owner. And it also involves work. I think the workers take a pay cut and they all go back and we've got the jobs back. And they all sing as we go. I think that's the name of the film. That, you know, workers and employers can overcome the difficulties at the end of the film and everyone's in it together. Isn't it great? You know, all the classes are back in the position that they should be in.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit like that. I mean, that's a classic sort of trope about industrial relations and comedies, I suppose. And it fits into that. It just isn't a very good example of the form, is it, really, unfortunately?
No.
Although I do think that it would be really interesting if you know, Nigel Farage, or if, you know, a viewer of GB News, I mean, the kind of person on the right now would just like, would they still chuckle away at this? Yeah, that's what they're really like. Yeah, that's where we're at now, but... No,
oh, I think
no,
not. No. I think that would be really... I mean, so as some listeners may know, I go on GB News quite a lot. And one of my roles there, because I'm basically their pet lefty, is to be the voice of defending unions. But I think even they don't think that unions have this kind of role anymore in a workplace. Right. And they think they're overmighty, but they think they're overmighty in terms of directing politicians rather than directing workplaces. Top.
Yeah, well, they'd be right in that respect anyway, wouldn't they? Because they don't.
They'd be right about they don't direct workplaces in the same way. I might disagree over whether they're right about being overmighty in directing politicians. Okay. Sorry, I was just seeing the screen. Sorry, I just scared Steve quite a lot there.
Yeah, there's a huge hand that sort of went for me on the screen, which is a sight which you are not, which you are denied, listener. So maybe just as well. And it certainly would be a very different expression, you know, maybe wrapping up a bit. Because I was thinking, as watching this, I was thinking, yeah, Ken Loach wouldn't be really coming out of this kind of stuff. And his stuff on the BBC TV, he was doing lots of very pro, you know, radical union stuff in the late 60s and the early 70s, like Rank and File, which we've still managed to avoid doing anything by Ken Loach, but I'm not suggesting that we should. But it's a very, very different perspective. But I think the view that the union, the role of the unions, I think was more pervasive. it might have not been popular in the Carry On context, but it certainly was pervasive in situation comedies, and that was what millions of people watched rather than Ken Loach films at this time.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, Carry On films were probably written by middle-class people for working-class people, with working-class people in mind.
Yes.
Ken Loach films are about the working class, but not for the working class.
Yes, I think that's entirely correct. On that bombshell, perhaps.
There you go, we've done Ken Loach.
Yeah. See you, Ken. See you, Ken. On that bombshell, perhaps we should end and wave goodbye to our listener. If they're still here, maybe they're not. Maybe they've gone already. But it's on Amazon. Carry On at Your Convenience. I'm sure it's probably on YouTube, and it will be on ITV4 probably at 3 a.m. on December the 28th, possibly. But check your double issue TV Times for that, if they still do it. And so it just behooves me to say thank you to my co-presenter, Emma.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And to say thank you to me, Steve, and also to thank Lord Stuart Wood for doing the theme tune, and to remind you, listener, if you're still there, that this is a Political Human production. And if you want to rate and review this on whatever platform you get it, please do.